to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 517. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. And I have with me Jeff Waddington, who serves the stated supply of Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. He's also one of our co-founders here at Reformed Forum. Welcome back, Jeff. It's always good to talk to you on a fine afternoon.
Oh, it's great to be here. The sun's going down here in the east, on the east coast. Looking forward to Thanksgiving Day tomorrow.
Yeah, we're recording late on a Wednesday, later, because I got caught in some holiday traffic on 294 coming back from Mid-America. But
anybody who's been on 294 will not.
It can get
that
backed up. Yeah, that's one of the main interstates that goes right by O'Hare Airport. So. You get hung up there and, you know, a lot of people coming in, a lot of people going out, and just seemed like everyone in the world. My class gets done at like 12:30, so we went and had lunch. But then coming back after that, it seemed like everyone had taken kind of the afternoon off of work and they're all trying to get places. So it seemed like most everyone in Chicagoland was out driving somewhere or other. But we're here. We're back in the studio, back at church.
Nice.
And we're looking forward to a good conversation today. Jeff and I are going to speak about a new festschrift or a celebration writing for Dr. Vern Poitras titled Redeeming the Life of the Mind. Very much looking forward to this, talking about this book. This is a festschrift published by Crossway. It's been edited by three people, John Frame, Wayne Gruden, and John Hughes. These are all essays in honor of Vern Poitras, and as you'd expect, forward by none other than J.I. Packer. it's the running joke. We love J.I. Packer, but he's either writing a foreword or writing a blurb for pretty much every single book out there. So he gets around. He reads a lot. So we've got a lot ahead of us, a lot to talk about, and we're very thankful for Crossway for giving us this opportunity. Jeff wrote an essay in it. I wrote an essay in it. Lane Tipton's got one as well. So some of our Reform Forum regulars, and we'll get into the contents therein and talk about the reception of the festschrift at the recent Evangelical Theological Society meeting. But before we do that, got a couple things to mention. As you always know, and I try to mention most every single episode, Christ the Center is a listener-supported, and we do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help us produce this program and all of our resources free of charge. We very much are thankful for all of the support that we receive for everything we do here to keep us on point, on mission, and we love to continue in this labor, but we really honestly do need your help, and we need your support. We're looking forward to a strong year end. We're going to be sending out an appeal, certainly through email at least, if not a few in actual postal mail. But as we look toward the end of the year, we'd like to start off and have a strong year end so that we can hit the ground running in January. So if you have some room in the budget and you've really been affected by Reformed Forum and very thankful for what we're doing, we would ask that you'd consider supporting us, even financially. And you can do that by visiting us online at reformedforum.org/donate. And there we encourage you to sign up even for a monthly gift, or you can set the frequency up for whatever you'd like, or perhaps even a one-time gift here at year-end. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and that means that in the United States, according to the rules of the IRS, your donations are tax deductible to the fullest extent of the law. And so that's just another incentive for you to be able to perhaps help us out. So we want to thank everybody now for close to 10 years of ministry here at Reformed Forum. Coming up January, this coming January, it'll be 10 years since we started Christ the Center. And we're looking forward to another 10 more. But we want to partner with you in that. So online today, reformedforum.org/donate. Thanks so much for your support of everything we do here at Christ the Center and our organization, Reformed Forum. Jeff, it's been a long time. We've been going at this for a while. I guess 10 years isn't that long in the grand scheme of things. But
no, but for when you think about the world of life.
When you think about the world of podcasts, we're ancient.
True, isn't it?
We were doing a podcast, I believe, before or close to the time at which Apple iTunes started listing podcasts. I started listening to podcasts before podcasts were even a thing that you could automatically do on an iPad. There was no podcast store. There was no place, no podcast directory. And there was no software. iTunes did not automatically do podcasts. And so when I started, you had to get some like very weird kind of clandestine software, and it would automatically download files to your computer. And then I'd have to take every morning and manually transfer them to my iPod through, and then sync it via USB. And then I would drive off to work or go to the gym and listen to my podcast that way. Things really changed with the smartphone.
Ride off to work on your horse?
Yeah, my horse. I ride on a steel horse.
A steel horse.
I'm wanted, dead or alive. No, I don't have a steel horse either. I have a 1999 Toyota Camry, so I'm far from being cool in anyone's book. But that's a fading glory. We're looking forward to a heavenly glory that is imperishable. And more along those lines, we're looking at some really stellar theology. We're very thankful here for a lot of the collection that we have. I'm thankful for all of it, but we're only going to talk about one essay of it today. Looking at Jeff's article in the Poitras Festschrift titled "Jonathan Edwards and God's Involvement in Creation, an Examination of Miscellanies, number 1263. So we're going to get into a topic that sometimes fires some people up when you start talking about Jonathan Edwards and creation. You know, what was his view? Are there any issues with his view? You know, there's a lot involved, and we're gonna talk about that today. But more generally speaking, Jeff, I want to talk to you about your recent trip out to ETS because they had a reception. And Crossway was kind enough to host a reception for Dr. Poitras, and they delivered the Festschrift to him. You know, I had an invitation since I was a contributor to the book, but given some family circumstances, I wasn't able to be there. How was it? I haven't heard. I assume it went well.
Yeah, I mean, it was not a reception in the sense that there were any, you know, hors d'oeuvres or beverages.
But you had like an event.
It was a presentation. It was really the last thing done officially, or the last segment. At any one time during ETS, during the times of the actual functioning of the conference, the meeting, you could have dozens, if not, 20, 30, or 40 presentations at a time.
All at once. You got to pick your spots. It's hard.
Right. I was wanting to go to one thing at one point, and I couldn't fit because the room was crowded out. That was my own experience. That was my only experience of that happening. But
it's probably one of the only places in the world where you might see people wearing tweed jackets sitting on a floor.
This is true. It was held. It met in Providence, Rhode Island. Was held at the Omni Hotel and at the Civic Center, which are right across the street from each other in downtown Providence. It was a beautiful venue. Enjoyed the fellowship and the networking and the presentations of presentation of the Festschrift to Dr. Poitras was the last slot on the Friday as we were heading the last thing we did before driving back to the Philadelphia area, and the Poitras's drove with me along with a few other folks, so we had a nice fun time, fun in quotes, I should say. We had good conversation,
I imagine,
to and from the book. Is a beautifully made book,
hardcover,
hardcover with dust jacket.
It's always laid out well. Crossway does a fine job on typography and everything, so it's well done,
nicely made. So it's a good tribute to Dr. Poitras. Dick Gaffin also has a chapter in
it. He does. His is titled "What Symphony of Sighs? Reflections on the Eschatological Future of the Creation." So there's quite a few. Let me just list some of the contributors. Probably won't have or bore people to tears with the titles of every single one, but here just listing the contributors. Dr. Poitras' sons, both of them wrote chapters, Ransom Poitras and Justin Poitras. And then you have also G.K. Beale, In Hwan Kim, Brandon Crow, Bob Kara, Ann Duguid, Lane Tipton, Dr. Gaffin, myself, Pierce Taylor Hibbs. He's written for Reform Forum quite a few times. Mr. Jeffrey C. Waddington. You got Peter Lilback, John Frame, Carl Truman, Brian Courtney Wood, Luke P. Y. Liu, Diane Poitras, a scholar in your own right, Wayne Grudem, and John Hughes. So that's a pretty loaded book. And that's comes it is, after it is. The Scripture Index, you know, 400-plus pages. So it's a tome.
Yeah, and it's nice that many of these folks I know personally. Luke Liu, for instance, is involved with the seminary where I taught back in May. He was my translator, actually.
Oh, really?
So if you see any of the pictures or the videos where I'm sitting giving a lecture, Luke is the one who's sitting next to me doing the translation. So that's nice. That was a nice treat to see that he, among many others that I met, contributed to this volume. Probably the most funny and enjoyable interaction I had was with Bob Kara, who's the provost of RTS. Works out of the Charlotte campus, but mm-hmm. He's provost for all of the campuses. And he was talking about my colorful clothing. As you know, I like colors. And he said, "When I first saw you, Jeff, I thought you were a liberal." I said, "No. I believe that." I like color. I believe, you know, God made color.
Of all people.
He must like it. So well, then he starts introducing
I know what you said. You probably said, I am a liberal of the old variety.
Yes, I should have thought of that. But
I'm not a monarchist.
He starts introducing me to some of his colleagues. He said, "This is Jeff Waddington. His wardrobe is based upon his doctrine of God." He dresses according to his doctrine of God. On that day, I had my magenta blazer.
Yeah, you wore that at the conference, yeah.
I did.
That's nice.
But anyway, so the presentation was made. Several folks spoke, gave brief comments, and then Dr. Poitras himself responded. Wayne Grudem was probably, I was going to say, moved the most. He's known Dr. Poitras since their days together, undergraduate days, or Dr. Grudem's undergraduate days at Harvard University. I think they first met in 1960 or 67. I forget which year it was. So he was visibly and obviously moved by this occasion. For which he, in many ways, was responsible.
Yeah.
Dr. Poitras, of course, being the humble man that he is, was a tad bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But Dr. Grudem said, "You're just going to have to sit and listen."
That's kind.
We were talking about this on the way to the conference, and one of my friends who was riding with us was talking about. I said to him, "I said, yeah, we're working on a festschrift for you." And he said, "Nah, you're not." I said, "Yeah, it's going to be called the short shrift." Oh, okay. So, anyways, it was a good conference. Lots of people, over covering the broad spectrum of evangelical theological commitments, lots of good interaction.
Yeah, the doctrinal statement of ETS, I believe you can find it in the inside cover of JETS whenever you open that up, or it's thereabouts. But it's basically two things, inerrancy of Scripture and Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity, roughly speaking.
Those are the two doctrinal.
I'm just thinking off the top of my head. But within that, you do find quite a wide variety. So even though it is, you know, more specifically the Evangelical Theological Society, it's still pretty broad. In biblical studies, you know, if you go to a biblical studies presentation within ETS, it's not going to be as broad as if you go to SBL. And usually those two are, you know, they have their meetings back to back. So a lot of guys
did chronologically, but they unusually, they didn't meet in the same city. The SBL and the American Academy of Religion met in Boston.
No kidding.
So not that far away, but not in the same city.
Wow. Now, Boston, we gotta take a trip to Boston, you and me, Jeff. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
I could do a conference definitely. In Boston. one of my best vacations in Boston. So, good times. Yeah. I know that's more closer to your neck of the woods, too. But, well, let's talk about your experience with Dr. Poitras. Obviously, you're close friends. You've been family friends with Dr. Poitras for many years. But how were you first introduced to his work? We'll begin, and then to him as a person.
Sure. I began reading his books back in the mid to late 80s. As I noted in the essay, probably the first two books would have been Symphonic Theology and the Science of Hermeneutics, Science and Hermeneutics, which are 87 and 88 respectively. I was reading Christianity Today, and he was often involved in writing or even referenced in the pages of that magazine back in those days. And then, of course, over the years, read lots of his books, The Shadow of Christ and the Law of Moses. And then, of course, I came to Westminster and had him as a professor. And then in 2000, when I graduated from the MDiv program, I actually candidated for the assistant pastorate position at his church. And his wife was on the pastoral search committee, and she was tasked with interviewing my wife.
Is this in Lansdale at the time?
This is being Lansdale.
Yeah.
The church they're still a part of.
Yeah.
And what was supposed to be a 20-minute interview went for 2 hours, and that's what I knew. And that's when they became fast friends, and basically we became close through my wife and Diane.
Yeah.
And so 17 years later, we've had good fellowship. We've been over to their home. They've been over to ours. You know, the children have grown up, together. All of the kids were relatively young when we first moved to the area in 97. Now they're all adults. And I feel old.
Yeah. Well, things change. But, we're very thankful for so many years of faithful service. And it's such a blessing to have friends that you grow with. And it's really pretty amazing when you look upon Dr. Poitras' career and you see that he has a PhD in mathematics from Harvard, that he has an MLit from Cambridge, and has done some significant work. In hermeneutics and language regarding there. He has a PhD in New Testament, I believe, from Stellenbosch, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And is there a THM in there somewhere from Westminster, an MDiv?
He has his MDiv. Trying to remember if he actually
did.
Did
he do one of those, odd kind of super degrees that, Dr. Van Hooser did?
They created it for him.
I think Grudem and Van Hooser, and I think I don't know if Grudem did, and then Poitras did one of those weird kind of express degrees.
I think it's still in the, well, what it is if, as I understand correctly, looking at, it's been a while since I looked at the catalog, but it's basically a lot more independent study.
Oh, I don't know if the degree exists anymore, does it? I've never heard of anybody doing it.
It did when I was doing the MDiv. It was still around. But I don't know that anybody other than the only people I know of are Van Hooser and Dr. Poitras.
If you make it down to the archive room in the Westminster Library, there are these odd colored dissertations or theses. It's because at Westminster, the MARs are called theses, and then the PhD projects are called dissertations. And so there's this let me get this right. Are they both red? No, I know the PhD dissertations are red.
PhDs are red, and the THMs are black.
Are black, and then the DMIN projects, I think, are blue or something like that.
Yeah, they're a different color. That way you can quickly determine.
Right, but then there are these weird, I think they're green. I think like the weird hybrid super degree or whatever you want to call it. It's not a PhD, it's not a THM, but it's kind of this weird MDiv THM combo.
It was a higher.
It's like a. I think it's green. There because I remember seeing him and I thought, what in the world is this? You know. Yeah, And so it's independent. There's a lot more independent study. It's a very fast degree, but it required, you know, kind of a superior academic intellect and capability.
Well, that was part of what they talked about during the presentation was his brilliance, and I use that word purposefully. He was embarrassed, no doubt, by that way of talking, but the truth is, he is. A brilliant man, godly man, a humble man, and a brilliant man. That combination, as you know, Camden, is unique.
It is. Utterly. Utterly.
I was just on Facebook a little earlier interacting with a professor, a friend of mine, and he was talking about how he's made it his goal to take new young scholars under his wings because he had heard stories and perhaps had even witnessed some scholars who were arrogant. So he made it his goal not to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell you that my experience, and I've only had one, I've been an associate member, student member, and then now full member of ETS since 1986, worked through that board pecking order. But this is my first annual conference. Thankfully, I didn't run across any of that. But Dr. Poitras is known for being both humble and brilliant, and he got his undergrad from Caltech.
Oh, yeah.
Which they talked about the average SAT score at Caltech. It reminded me of my experience years ago in high school visiting MIT.
Yeah.
Walking into the central lobby of the main building. The old building with the rotunda and feeling stupid just looking at the science projects in the wall, you know, that are on display. And I'm going, wow. And I was there as part of the High School Air Force ROTC unit visiting the MIT ROTC unit. And I got to see such things as the nuclear laboratory and all that kind of thing. So I was – science is not my strength, but
– Sure.
But anyway, so I understood, you know, Caltech to be that kind of a place.
Mm.
But anyways, he has as you mentioned, the PhD from Harvard, and he had that before coming to Westminster.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, because of that unique situation, they came up with this degree, this unique track, MDiv, which was advanced. It was it was more rigorous. If you can imagine, more rigorous than the regular MDiv pastoral track.
I know.
From what you say, it must have had a thesis as part of its requirement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did.
Plus, you know, the independent study thing.
Well, we're looking at Dr. Poitras's career, and it's wide and varied. You know, he started off at least in the theological seminary realm in New Testament. But he also has that background in language literature. That makes sense with New Testament, but also mathematics. And now he's branched out, you know, in the recent books he started writing maybe 10 years ago, into worldview thinking, and he's gotten into sociology, science, you know, all sorts of other fields. We know your expertise is more specifically regarding Jonathan Edwards and apologetics and systematic themes therein. We're looking here at an examination of Miscellanies number 1263, which covers Jonathan Edwards' views on God's involvement in creation. You know, when we're writing a Festschrift, you know, you often want to write something that is compelling, but you most importantly want to write something that honors a person by either engaging in their work or writing something on a theme that, you know, touches upon themes that they have dealt with throughout their academic career. And you explain this in the essay, but for the listeners, how does this topic in Jonathan Edwards, and how does the figure of Jonathan Edwards more generally really relate to Dr. Poitras? What is the connection that warrants a chapter, more specifically in a Festschrift?
Sure. Basically, in Edwards' day, of course, a minister was often the most educated man in a given community, right? And That education often involved a fair bit of exposure to what was originally in those days called natural philosophy. We would now call it the natural sciences. And Edwards is known, anybody who knows Edwards knows no doubt that he had an interest in natural science, just as part of his wide-ranging interests in many, many areas of intellectual endeavor. And so he would, not only did he delve into it in his student days at Yale, but he kept up an interest as his, the final volume in the letterpress edition of the Yale version of his works is a reading catalog. It's all the books he either read or wanted to read, include a lot of things that would be classified as science. And so that ties Edwards and Poitras together. But then there's, of course, they're both ministers, they're both reformed, they're both interested in science, they're both brilliant. And so, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why you would tie them together. But also, the most important one, actually, was just in conversations with Dr. Poitras and the article I mentioned shortly that he published a few years ago, where in the conversations with him, and then some of them must have initially occurred around the time that he published his article on science, the laws of science, the laws of nature, not to be confused with natural law in the philosophical sense, although there is a connection, but laws of nature are actually God's normal way of doing things. And there's more to say, which I'll say a little further on. It's the article, Why Scientists Must Believe in God, Divine Attributes of Scientific Law, 2003. It was an article in JETS, the Journal for the Evangelical Theological Society. And I remember reading that and talking with him and saying, do you realize how close you are to Edwards in your thinking? And he did not. So I was surprised, but he was not aware of Edwards' discussions on this topic.
Yeah.
And that's why this chapter, basically, because this miscellany, it's not the only one that deals with the issue, but it's the longest one in terms of length in one. And we can talk a little bit, if you want, about what miscellanies were.
Yeah, why don't you? I mean, you'd imagine that if this is a kind of a recurring theme or something he'd been thinking about, that you would find them in several miscellanies.
Miscellanies are a series of semi-private notebooks, and that itself is a discussion in Edwards' studies as to what is the nature of the miscellanies books. Were they meant to be purely private? Were they the, you know, basically the equivalent of his published treatises? The fact is they are semi-private. Not everything that appear in the miscellanies, which are now published. They were not published in Edwards' lifetime. Some of them were published in a heavily redacted form by his grandson in the original, what now the Banner of Truth or Hendrickson edition of the works of Edwards. Those miscellanies are reworked. And I mean, I wouldn't mind using the expression worked over.
Right.
The miscellanies are just a and they're not the only semi-private notebooks he had. He had ones on typology. He had one on the Book of Revelation. He had the blank Bible, which is similar, but it's a running commentary on the Bible as a whole. So he was in the habit of reading and thinking with a quill in hand. So this is just an example of that. The miscellanies books are a wide-ranging theological and philosophical topics, whereas some of the other notebooks are more focused. Mm-hmm. So the miscellanies, you could hop from justification to sanctification to continuous creation to God's relationship to his world and back and forth.
Just as the mind works. I mean, this is, you know, writing is thinking. It's not in this case, it's not writing is a product of thought. Obviously that is, but in this sense, right. They're also writing is a different mode of thought itself.
Right. And that's why you and so that's part of the question is how do you interpret this stuff? Because it's not all meant for wasn't all meant for public consumption.
Right.
Now, the reason why I call it semi-private is there are large chunks of material throughout the miscellanies that do get brought over into sermons and books like Freedom of the Will, Religious Affections, and Original Sin.
Yeah.
So we can't where he literally lifted them. You know, they sure. didn't have cut and paste. They did have cut and paste. It really was cut and paste, as opposed to what we call cut and paste on the computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he also had this whole system of cross referencing that he developed in his notebooks.
In his notebooks.
And he had a paper shortage, so it's you can imagine it's interesting seeing these volumes.
Sure.
But anyway, so that's...
Well, you can imagine him writing, I suppose, by saying they're semi-private, he's writing immediately for himself because he's thinking. He's right-thinking. You know, that's kind of my term for that. But at the same time, he is writing with a perspective, meaning that he has an awareness that this material can and perhaps would be used for other things or other people would read it one day. Or perhaps he's writing with a distance perspective of his future self. You know, I think a lot of people will do that in your journal. You write, but you don't write in the same way that you have a mental, thought that you keep to yourself. By the act of writing it down, there is some measure of disclosure to the world or to the future reader, whoever that might be.
What I didn't mention was that he shared these books with his ministerial interns. So even in his own life, apart from publication, he didn't feel that they were completely private. So that's why I didn't say they're not they're semi-private.
Understood.
Because he felt comfortable with letting his interns read them. And he lifted large amounts of material and used them in things that were public.
Understood.
Public documents, and so out of that. Comes this miscellany, which deals with God's relationship to the creation and the various gradations of interaction and the relationship of what we would call laws of nature. And in my chapter, I have basically a twofold argument. First, Christian theologians and ordinary Christians can be both appreciative of contemporary science and critical of how it is practiced when measured against Scripture. And then second, I intend to show a measure of continuity in the thinking of Edwards and Poitras. There is, as it were, a family resemblance.
Yeah, I like
so that. That's the argument. I've used the family resemblance idea in other places with regard to Edwards. It allows, as you would understand, both for continuity and discontinuity, in other words, variation. In other words, I'm looking for unity, not uniformity.
Right? Kind of like as we talked to Randall Peterson about the definition of a Puritan. Well, maybe it's better to think of a family resemblance rather than, some sort of hard boundary. Somebody might have the eyes and nose, but not the eye color,
Right.
But they still look like they're a member of the family.
And I think that's Randall's idea, as his dissertation was on this more general topic, is helpful in that regard. As far as I know, I did not get it from Randall, but
no. It's an everyday metaphor. It's good,
right? Mm-hmm. And then what I was just interested in, and I had thought, wow, they really do have their ideas converge. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to sit down and look at this and see if it's worth bringing them together. And others will have to judge of its value. But I think that they're not identical. In fact, I argue in the chapter that Poitras makes some advance on Edwards without trying to, of course, but he does because of his own science background. And you recognize there's almost 300 years between the two of them. So the science, Edwards,
the
case
new science,
Poitras' case are two different things.
Sure.
I do give some space to the historical background of Edwards' understanding of science. What you made reference to already, the new science, that is the science of Isaac Newton. And others. So we're talking about science that arises in the context of the Enlightenment, really, right? And Edwards is Edwards is appreciative and critical of the science that he witnesses arising. In other words, he appreciates where he thinks it's right, and he has no problem dissenting where he thinks it's wrong. And primarily the area, and this is hits upon a major theme in the chapter, primarily where he's going to dissent is in the mechanistic, materialistic bent of much of the science. And again, this is not necessarily the fault of Isaac Newton, Sir Isaac Newton, but of those perhaps who followed him. And Isaac Newton was a theist of a sort, not a Trinitarian. So unfortunately, not Orthodox, as far as I remember.
Yeah.
But he wrote Bible commentaries of all things. So did John Locke. it's interesting, but you sometimes yeah. That's glossed over, right? Because wow. It doesn't fit with the typical paradigm of Enlightenment thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
So Edwards, I'll just read one short quote from Avahu Zakai, who is a scholar of Edwards, who's written on Edwards' philosophy of nature and his philosophy of history. So his areas of interest and mine cross paths frequently. Edwards developed his cosmological conception of real being and true substance in order, in part, to refute materialism. He rejected Hobbes's materialism, that is, Thomas Hobbes, which held that the universe is a complete, autonomous, and self-sustaining system of unthinking bodies, subject only to inherent, necessary, and mathematically exact laws of mechanical causation, because it ruled out the divine and providential government of the world. That's a really nice summary of Edwards' reaction to the rise of the new science of his day.
Yeah. Well, it's important, that we understand the historical context, because that also helps us understand, what Edwards is dealing with and interacting with at the time. You list here in the essay three and possibly four elements or theological, yep. philosophical elements that Edwards embraced, things that start to come into his recollection or at least his understanding of how God is involved in creation. Let's start with the first one. You speak about idealism, but this is a Trinitarian theistic idealism. What is idealism, and how is Edwards' use of idealism quite different from what we might find with idealist philosophers such as Georg Hegel, for example?
Well, of course, idealism as a philosophy goes all the way back, I suppose, to Plato. And so it has to do with the human mind. Does it interact with the external world, or does it interact with ideas that are reflections of the external world, or does it interact with ideas that have little or no connection with the external world? And you already mentioned Hegel, but Kant before him would also be an idealist.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's also we think of Bishop Berkeley, and his form of idealism, right. Sometimes immaterialism.
Spelled like Berkeley, but it's Berkeley.
Yes, it's pretty correct. It's pronounced Berkeley. You learn the hard way. You say it wrong to someone who knows, and they correct you, brother. it's like some people like to correct us when we say Edinburgh. We didn't say Edinburgh. We said Edinburgh.
It's not Edinburgh.
It's not Edinburgh. No.
with that first time you say Karl Barth.
Karl Barth. That's right. It's one of the first things you learn is Bart.
It's
Barth.
The first thing you learn. Yeah.
It's the first.
So Edwards has got a different version here, and obviously
he's got what I call the Trinitarian theistic idealism. So he shares with Berkeley. I say immaterialism, I guess. Although even that, I'm not sure it's a completely accurate way of describing what he's talking about. What he's getting at is the notion that spirits are true substance and matter is less substance and more shadow. It's the exact reverse of how we typically think, right? We think of matter, the stuff of like this book, as real and spirits being questionable in terms of the reality, right? So he's reversed that, and everything depends upon God's mind. So typically idealism is to be perceived, right? We perhaps many of our listeners have heard the conundrum, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the idealist question. I mean, that would never, or that question would never arise, that cute little question. And my response is yes, because God is present, of course. God is the one upholding, but of course, most people asking right. that question aren't worried about God.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, so the question is, does it make a sound? Because they're assuming that sound is, there is no such thing as sound until it hits the eardrum, right?
Right.
Edwards has a notion of like that about color. Color is not in the thing, but is created by light interacting with the surface of things. Or, you know, that even that's not, I guess, quite right, because it's the human mind seeing light interacting with the surface of other things. So idealism gets its name because of the idea. In other words,
as opposed to realism.
Right,
in distinction from realism, yeah.
Sometimes idealism will be called representationalism, the idea that the human mind does not interact with the extramental world, but with representations of the extramental world. And if you want an interesting and somewhat humorous discussion, you should read The Warranted Christian Belief, where Alvin Plantinga talks about a couple different readings of Immanuel Kant's form of idealism and the noumenal phenomenal realm, and whether the noumenal realm actually exists or doesn't exist. Because there's questions as to whether he can talk about a noumenal realm, but is it real? But Plantinga is a good writer, as you know, and so it's always interesting, even though I disagree with him on so many things. But he gives a nice discussion of that whole issue. I don't reference him, by the way, in my article. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Sure. But you got Edwards, who's an idealist, but he's definitely a Trinitarian theistic idealist.
Trinitarian,
and everything dependent upon
Edwards
God's personality and his mind.
Whatever is in the mind of God, dependent upon. Its existence depends upon the mind of God. Now, when you put it that way, I don't think any of us would disagree with that, that all of reality, whatever, you know, form it takes, is dependent upon God's will, God's knowledge, his intellect, that kind of thing. But anyway, so that's to distinguish his form of and it's also, I guess, a form of immaterialism, and that's where it has, you know, similarities to Berkeley. And for years there was a discussion as to whether Edwards owed his thinking to Berkeley, but most everybody thinks he developed it independently of Berkeley. Then you have, related to these, you have the continuous creationism and occasionalism. And it's interesting that we're talking about this, because just today in my mail arrived a new book by Mark Hamilton.
Wow.
with the title, A Treatise on Jonathan Edwards' Continuous Creation and Christology, where he's going to deal with this issue. Obviously, I did not have the opportunity to interact with it in my article. So my chapter is, of course, already out of date. It's like driving a car off the lot of a dealer. You know, it's like buying a computer.
It's 4 days old.
Yep. There you go. What can you do about it? So continuous creation is simply the notion that the distinction between creation and conservation or preservation is not a distinction of reality. It's not a distinction of substance, pardon the pun. Because the one is the creation is the first instance, and preservation is the second, third, and fourth instance. And with it goes the notion that reality passes out of existence and back into existence by God's superintendence. In other words, nothing is self-sustaining and I think all of us would agree with that notion. But it tends to then do away with the distinction between creation and providence, or creation and preservation. And occasionalism is the idea that God is the only actor in the world, in the universe. And often the occasionalism and continuous creationism tend to get blended into one idea, but they're actually two distinct ideas, not only in Edwards, but in philosophy more broadly speaking. And then the final thing which I address, but as I don't think I treat it as a major theme, although it is Edwards' holding to the chain of being, or the analogia entis. Those of who have heard our conversations about Aquinas and so forth will be familiar with that language. Edwards was a typical of his day. He held to it. And the idea of the chain of being is that creation, there are gradations of being in the universe. God at the top and inert matter at the bottom, and mm-hmm. human being somewhere on the ladder or the chain of being. Mm-hmm. And this particular miscellany, 1263, actually partakes, in my opinion, of that the chain of being makes itself manifest in the miscellany. He doesn't say it, but it's I think it's there in the background. If you're familiar with Thomas Aquinas's five ways, I believe it's the fourth way that is based upon gradations of being. Edwards will talk more about perfections of being, gradations of perfection of being, and his whole notion of fitness or aesthetics.
Yeah.
It's in the background here. Mm-hmm. Edwards is arguing in the among other things in Miscellany 1263 that laws of nature are not things that get in the way of God's existence and activity, but are the ways that He normally acts. Basically, that's that in a nutshell, that's what he's arguing. Okay. That laws, what we call laws of nature, are a human formulation describing what is in fact God's activity. And what he does is he distinguishes between more and less arbitrary divine activity. By what he means by arbitrary is not irrational or chaotic, which is sometimes what we mean by arbitrary. But in fact, what he means is that the higher on the chain of being, the more sentient and we say intellectual and spiritual a thing is, as a, say God, angels, and human beings at the somewhere at the top, and then animals under that, sentient animals under that. The higher the chain of up on the chain of being you go, or scale of being. The more arbitrary God's acts are, that means he's not following the laws of nature that he does follow with those on the lower rungs of the ladder. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. He treats them different, more or less, because it's unnecessary for him to.
Right. I mean, he's it has to do with secondary causality. And that's a whole new discussion going on with Edwards. Richard Muller a few years ago gave a lecture at the Jonathan Edwards Center at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where he argued that Edwards had departed from the Reformed Scholastic or classical Reformed understanding of freedom of the will, basically, in a nutshell, denying secondary causality, etc. And I can see how that would be the case. And in fact, there's now a whole book by Fisk called Jonathan Edwards' Turn from the Classic Reformed Tradition of Freedom of the Will. And it'll be interesting to read that, because I have acquaintances who I know that have actually disproved that argument even before I read the book. So that'll be interesting. But anyways, this I would argue that this particular miscellany would be key to undermining that idea that Edwards doesn't believe in secondary causes. Remember the Westminster Confession talks about God being sovereign?
Yes. And
that the purpose of his will or the plan of his will, he brings it about.
But that he doesn't destroy or whatever, but he establishes them.
Contingency, right. In a great sense, I think that's what Edwards is doing, actually, in Miscellany 1263. His discussion is distinguishing between secondary causes and tertiary causes and how God acts through all of them. In other words, he's not arguing that God acts when he says he's arbitrary. It doesn't mean he's acting somehow less directly, but that he's upholding in all instances, God is upholding the process. But it's in on the lower rungs of the chain of being, the ladder of being. There's more specificity we can look to laws of nature. The higher up the ladder, the less there is of the rigidity in God's acting according to the laws that he himself has established. See, one of the things Edwards is responding to, or two things, the materialism of Thomas Hobbes and the mechanicalism coming from the handling of Isaac Newton's science. So that he's rejecting both the mechanicalism and materialism in this particular miscellany. He's wanting to uphold God's immediate or God's intimate involvement in the whole process. That's what he's upholding in this particular miscellany. And I go into some detail about that. And then I do talk about the new science of Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, and others. I mentioned Davahu Zakai and his book on Jonathan Edwards' philosophy of nature. He goes into some detail about various Christian reactions to the rise of the new science. For instance, he has a chapter or two on John Donne. You've heard of John Donne.
Oh, yeah. I read his poetry.
Right.
A metaphysical poet.
He reacts very strongly to this and very negatively to the rise of the new science. And so he's a foil for his treatment of Edwards. Yeah. Edwards is not nearly as negative in terms of the thrust of the new science. He is negative with regard to the drive, you know, the God of the gaps, which is tends to be what happens, right? God retreats. The more the humans can explain the universe, the less we need God as a hypothesis. You may remember the French scientist, is it Laplace, who said, God, I have no need of that hypothesis kind of thing. So that's what Edwards is responding to, then I give a preliminary conclusion, you know, where I basically say that I believe Edwards' goal is commendable. And some of what he does is still useful, but his idealism I don't find biblically warranted. I put forward a covenantal realism in one of the footnotes.
Yeah.
That's hardly original with me.
Which is not at all to say that everything depends upon God's existence and his sustenance, but it's a different, you know, more biblical
right.
construct.
Well, I affirm with Edwards that God upholds, if God withdraws his sustaining of the universe, everything would go to naught, right? But it's exactly how do you understand that the relationship right between God and creation, and Edwards has some helpful thoughts, and this is where I think Dr. Poitras's article brings in some fine tuning, if you will, his article Why Scientists Must Believe in God. Basically, Dr. Poitras's article is showing that natural laws or laws of nature are often described in the same way that we describe the attributes of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sum and substance of his article. And so he says, laws of nature are simply descriptions or are the way God normally acts, his routine or ordinary way of acting. And miracles are his extraordinary way of acting. And one of the points of that way of construing things is that God doesn't have to break into the universe.
Right.
Nor is he breaking any laws because he's the one that made them.
Right.
I mean,
and
the
continues
laws
them.
Are, right.
He's we're not deists either.
Right. The laws, and that's one of the things that Edwards would say,
yeah.
is the laws, what we call laws of nature, are not themselves self-sustaining. They are things that God upholds because they're descriptions of his ordinary way of acting. Mm-hmm. You see, very often scientists and others get nervous when you talk about God having sovereignty because they think that means that God is willy-nilly or incoherent or chaotic.
Right, which would mean that all scientific experimentation would be worthless.
Yeah, it goes out the window. And of course, there's nothing to suggest that that's even the case, biblically speaking, right? Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Poitras is advancing that argument. Now, he's writing from within the Vantillian-Kuyperian frame of reference. These are thinkers, of course, who come after the time of Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
But he thankfully doesn't share the immaterialist, idealist philosophical ideas that Edwards adopts early on in his life as a student at Yale. In his notebook, either as a student at Yale or as a tutor at Yale, in volume 6 of the Yale edition of the works of Edwards, the scientific and philosophical writings, he outlines his idea that we would surely define as continuous creation and occasionalism. Occasionalism and continuous creationism combined seem to undermine the moral responsibility of human beings.
And I think
Mark Hamilton's new book here is also going to say that if that understanding of Edwards were true, it also undermine the human nature of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so he's going to say that means that we're not getting something quite right in terms of understanding of Edwards. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Let me ask you a question here. I mean, with all that being said, another thing that continues to creep up in the essay, but it always is an issue whenever we talk about Edwards' views of creation, and that's the charge that he might have tended toward panentheism. Can you describe what panentheism is and why some people might see that in some features of Edwards' theology?
Well, there's pantheism, which, of course, is the more common idea. Pantheism is that everything is God. Panentheism is that everything is in God, which is a different thing altogether, but closely related.
Yeah.
So the panentheism, of course, Edwards would say, well, Paul in Acts chapter 17, in his address to the philosophers at Mars Hill, says that, you know, citing both Epimenides and Aratus, you know, those wonderful quotes that he makes of philosophers.
In him we live and move and have our being.
Right. Yeah. And so Edwards, would say there is where he would get his biblical basis for if he is a panentheist, and John Gerstner and John Cooper both agree that he is. But I have to do further the study on the issue because God exists on a different plane. I don't mean aeroplane either.
Oh, okay.
He exists on a different plane from his creatures, which means it's the same.
Oddly enough, because you've just talked about the analogia entis.
Right. If you've read any of Scott Oliphant's work on Thomas, and by the way, we should plug his new book on Thomas Aquinas in the Great Thinkers series, is a series, by the way, in which you will have a volume. on Carl Rahner, and Lane Tipton will have a volume
and
as
Barth.
Well. Carl Barth. Carl Barth. That's so bad. But anyway.
Bill Dennison has one on Karl Marx.
Karl Marx.
So we've got three Karls at least represented. We're looking for a few more.
There you go. the chain of being rears its ugly head again.
Oh yeah, it's always coming around.
So and that's so Pan and see if the chain of being is actually true, and God is included in it, and that's why I mentioned Scott Oliphant's work. You end up with at least two forms of the an analogy, intrinsic attribution and proper proportion. But of course, there's also extrinsic attribution, although that's proper proportion. Forget that. There are, if you read studies of Thomas's doctrine of analogy, you'll find that there are different kinds of analogy. But the problem is, on the one hand, God to relate to his creatures has to be in the chain. On the other hand, he's not in the chain.
Right. So it's a tension.
Which is it?
That's the issue. That's the tension you find in Thomas's philosophy.
I suspect theology. Edward's not a student of Thomas. I mean, if you look at his, first of all, any reference to Thomas in Edward's writings is always negative because of the Roman Catholicism. He doesn't have any of Thomas's, let me be careful about that. His grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, may have had Thomas's works, in his library, but there's no evidence that he read at any length Thomas. But of course, you know, once Thomas is in the bloodstream, he's in the bloodstream, right? So Thomas might have come to Edwards indirectly through someone else.
Hmm.
And if you've read anything on Edwards' academic training, both at Yale, you'll know that it was very eclectic. It is in the Reformed Scholastic period, or, you know, at least the writers that he read were Reformed Scholastics in that mold. But the chain of being is not limited to Thomas. It's ubiquitous.
Oh, of course.
Right? It's a ubiquitous philosophical idea. But it's related to the panentheism or pantheism, because if you buy the chain of being idea, then you're committed to some form of at least panentheism, that we are all in God. But the reason I wanted to get to is, if God's on a different plane than his creation, then that seems to contradict the idea of panentheism, or at least panentheism, because we all recognize that God is everywhere. He fills all space, if you will, but that doesn't mean
he's
crowds
immense.
Out.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't mean crowds out creation. So that means we're talking about two different kinds of being, which you and I already know.
And this might get us into a wild conversation we had with Glenn Clary about like Meredith Klein's form of dimensionalism in God, Heaven, and Armageddon.
You see, though, that it's interesting. It reappears. It has to reappear because it comes up because, if for nothing else, Paul's language in Acts 17, in him we live and move and have our being. And of course, we can understand that in a thoroughly Orthodox sense. And so that's what makes the question, was Edwards a panentheist, as always, a matter for academic dispute.
So let me finish things off, put a point on this by asking you this direct question that'll kind of combine Edwards and Poitras and show how they're related, because the answer that you'll provide, I assume, would be an answer given by both of these figures. And the question is this: how can the consistent Christian be involved in scientific pursuits?
Well, to recognize the legitimacy of the scientific enterprise per se. In other words, there's nothing illegitimate about being involved in the scientific enterprise. However, the scientific enterprise, the scientists, are, like all human beings, affected by the fall. And therefore, science is not cordoned off from the rest of what humans know and experience. That is, scientists are sinners, and therefore sometimes they fudge their information, their experimentation. Sometimes they're committed to models for explaining the world that are not sound. And these are things we can say about other disciplines as well. So it's not unique to science.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, because of God's common grace, scientist, even if she is an unbelieving scientist, will come across aspects of truth because they live in God's world and are surrounded by God's revelation. And then, of course, if a scientist becomes a Christian as opposed to a Christian scientist, I had to do that one. Then in that case, they're being restored after the image of God. Right. And so therefore, both because of common grace and saving grace or special grace, science is a worthy enterprise. Edwards predates the antithetical discussions of a Kuiper or a Van Til. Although, as I say in the article, because I don't want to fall into the error of historicism, which is to reduce everything to the historical context. In other words, to the human, purely human historical context. Edwards has the same Bible that Van Til and Kuiper had, and Bovink, right?
Right.
So he had the same Holy Spirit, which means he could have come to similar insights.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, Scott Oliphant makes the same comment that I make, but I'm making it with regard to Edwards. He makes it with regard to Thomas in his new book on Thomas Aquinas and the Great Thinker series that PNR is publishing, which, I like to say, it means that great minds think alike. But as my wife says, fools seldom differ. I say, grass doesn't grow. How do I say it? Grass doesn't grow
on June on Tuesdays.
It doesn't grow in concrete either, as my wife would say. Yeah.
Remind my wife. I'm sure would be quick to remind me that when we're talking about the Great Thinkers series, we're talking about the subjects of the books, not the authors.
Well, that's true. However, to be able to understand a great thinker, you have to be a pretty good thinker.
Yeah. If
and you don't pay me to say that, but it's true, isn't it?
Well, that's, I guess, for the other scholars to decide. But right.
All of this is said, ultimately because we want to understand God's way with the world, and of course we're dependent on revelation to do that. And I think Edwards would affirm that, but I think Poitras actually, makes it more clear, mm-hmm. and it's a more programmatic element in his approach, and therefore an improvement.
Amen. Well, I do want the listeners to know about this book. It's available now. People can go grab it. The Westminster Bookstore has a great price on it. You get it. Redeeming the Life of the Mind, Essays in Honor of Verne Poitras. It's published by Crossway. MSRP is $50, but you can get it for 42% off if you head over to WTSbooks.com. They got it for $29. It's a hardcover, so it's a substantial book, over 400 pages, hardcover with dust jacket, as you'd expect from Crossway, very well done. Laid out well. And so you can pick this book up. I've got links to the book. And by clicking those links, you can also help us out with some affiliate income by using the links that we have in our episode description. It's edited by John Frame, Wayne Grudem, and John Hughes. And with a contribution from our dear friend, Jeff Waddington. Thanks so much for talking about this today, Jeff. It's always a great pleasure to speak with you. And I'm sure we'll circle the wagons and talk more about this festschrift in the future. We'll keep festing this schrift.
There you go.
Anyway, I do want people to check us out online as well at reformedforum.org. We want to thank thank everybody for listening, and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.